Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring this podcast. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System, you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. At hundreds of locations across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's unifiedhealing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
Welcome to episode 318 of the Barcelona Podcast, brought to you by the Blue Wire Podcast Network. I'm Dan Hilton, and he's Emil Evanesian. And Emil, while my microphone wasn't working today, we thought it was you. It happens to be me, but that gave us enough time to really process the Sam Umtiti news. So yes, we have a lot to talk about today. We've got El Clasico to preview at the end. We've got some Barca Granada, unfortunately, to continue to go over. But I think where we start the show is with our old pal Sam Umtiti and his commitment to the club, which is now longer, but also very much helps in the short term.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you and I were chatting, and I completely agree with you that this is a win-win for all involved. I mean, Samuel Umtiti has, on the one hand, just functionally, this is a huge help to the club. Like, he reduces his annual salary. So it allows them to register Ferran Torres, which is huge. You know, he has to make a longer commitment, but at the same time, there doesn't seem to be a huge market for his services even a year and a half from now. So at the very least, he's able to lock in all the money that he was, you know, he'd agreed to, that he was contracted to receive, but do so in a way that provides the club with more flexibility and allows them to get, you know, a new young star in the door. And, you know, for all involved, I mean, the club should be really happy. He should be really happy, and certainly I hope the fans take it easy on him now. You know, at the very least, he's, you know, they figured out a way. He's going to be made whole as far as the money that he agreed to. And all the while, he did what he needed to be done to help the club in the short term as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the word there is amortization, where the club is amortized his salary over the course of what was supposed to be a year and a half, and they've extended it through 2026. So he's just making a little bit so more
four and a half time. Instead of one and a half. Yeah.
Right. And I believe because that number is then going to get low enough next summer, 2023, that there is a termination fee that we've heard that is like possible, where the club can basically just buy him out at that point, because the number will be low enough and reasonable enough where it won't really destroy their salary number either. For Umtiti, who's played all of 90 minutes this season, this deal to be done. Well, I'll talk about like the fan reaction to him and all that in a second, but it's very clear that this situation is very different than Coutinho's. Because with Umtiti's injuries, and you would understand this, right? I think from a business perspective, where I do defend Umtiti a little bit, is that people say, oh, he needs to have more. Why is he not full of shame? As a player, if you want to be the best, why are you not like taking less money? But I think it actually tells a lot more about where he's at in his career than where Coutinho might be. Umtiti, because of his knee injuries, you know, we saw the level he was at. We know, I mean, it's a well-trod path. The knee injuries happened, 2018 World Cup. He doesn't have surgery. Instead, he wins the World Cup. That's what he chose to do with his career. He has never been the same player, will never be the same player, a shell of himself, still under the age of 30. And for him, the contract he signed for Barcelona, he will never receive that money again. That's it. Right. We know that he will never, ever be able to get back physically to where he would, well, to where he was even. And even then, when he signed that contract, he was 24, which means he was entering his peak. And so that any contract he ever signs again is going to be 1/10 of that number. And so him, his family, everybody involved in his peripheral wants to basically make the money that he had earned when he signed that contract. Because Barca gave him that deal because he was coming off, I mean, and people trying to do revisionist history. But I said on the show 4 years ago that he was one of the top 3 to 5 center backs in the world in 2017. And I stick by that. I thought he was. And that is the contract that Barca paid for. So yeah, I mean, unfortunately they are on the hook to deal with that contract. And I think, again, he earned that contract then, and he just hasn't been able to make good out of it because of those injuries he had. And Barca didn't put a fort de jour or a force de jour. Now I found it sounds like the act of God.
Force majeure.
Force majeure where basically they could have said, hey, your injuries were just, you know, too much. Like we were able to terminate you early, which it didn't do. Like they trusted him. And in a lot of Bartomeu contracts, you know, there wasn't a lot of out for the club.
But yeah. And you know, while that's true, that one of all the contracts that were handed out during the Barto era, I completely agree with you. It was fully, fully justified. I mean, prior to the 2018 World Cup, this guy was a colossus. I mean, he was as untouchable as, I remember I wrote a piece kind of, you know, previewing the Barca players that will be at the World Cup and just kind of summing them up. I remember I wrote about Umtiti at the time that he was the most important player on the squad, not named Messi. And I stood by it then. I stand by it now. At that time, that was true. And there was no conceivable way that you could let this guy, you know, start winding down his contract or get unhappy. He was that level of untouchable. He was an absolute rock at the back. And they gave him the contract that he deserved. I mean, for all the hilarious missteps and misfires of the Bartomeu regime, this was not one of them. What's happened in hindsight? I mean, it was good process, bad result.
Right.
I mean, you do that every time. And if the guy gets hurt, that sucks, but it was a risk worth taking.
It's also too, his salary at the time was also based on the salary structure that was created. Looking at the number, his number was based on what Sergio Roberto was making at the time.
Yeah.
A very similar number. And so, I mean, that's why they're making similar numbers now as Roberto is working on his renewal, and whether or not the club is basically going to do the same thing to Roberto, who's one of the captains and one of their own, where it's basically, do we just extend his contract for two more years at smaller numbers, or do we attempt to just eat it and potentially let him walk for free? Or do we really want Sergio Roberto? Like, those are all questions about Roberto, which I think him being Catalan and him being a captain makes it even more complicated than the Umtiti situation. But yeah, it's also an indictment that Umtiti gets the blame for, but it's an indictment of, yes, that all contracts, all salaries, the entire financial system at Barcelona had just gone haywire. And part of that is the fact that Messi was making so much, it continued to push all those numbers forward. And that just continued to be a problem. So it sounds like, you know, I'm going full in on the defense of Umtiti or whatever, but it's just, this is one of the last vestiges. You can be frustrated by the situation, but this is one of those last vestiges of continuing to clean up the mess. And where I'm going to turn this completely positive is, instead of talking about Umtiti anymore, because I think with this contract extension, I mean, for all the hand-wringing you could say about the past summers, right? Like, if Umtiti had done this, would Messi be able to stay? No, like, it continues to be. All the things that happened, Griezmann being loaned out, Messi having to leave on a free, all of that still had to happen for any business to be done at all. So I want
to
make
that was just to start playing this year.
Right, with Memphis. And Messi. Right. Yeah. So I just want to make that very, very clear. So even if Umtiti made the decision earlier, it really wouldn't have changed that much. And now Umtiti doing this club this quote unquote favor, right? But by getting what he's deserved and by doing this club the favor, it does set up, it's a good situation for everybody. It's a win-win that now Umtiti can either, he has the flexibility to either go away for a year and try in 2022, 2023 to basically find his place in professional football, or listen, he can still fight for his spot at FC Barcelona, and then he's a free agent in 2023 anyway, because he signs off for that, you know, to have his club
terminated. Yeah, he can be bought out.
So if he really believes in himself, sure, do that. That said, again, I'm going to spin this in that Matteo Alemanni, and it's not all the credit to him, because there are a lot of other voices and hands and agents and different people and financial consultants doing their jobs. But what Matteo Alemanni has done in 6 months, we're talking about the big picture, like as much as Holland is the thing we're not talking about because that's what gets clicks or whatever. There is still this huge mess. And I think for those who've kind of been in it, I mean, again, I host two shows a week, so I'm constantly in the wage numbers and being asked questions, all this stuff. So for him to, not being Alemanni, first, the Dembélé situation was always in the player's hands. I want to make that very clear. Even over the summertime, he didn't have to renew. And it's that whole thing where, you're kind of, if a player doesn't want to stay, you are at the mercy of the player who doesn't want to stay, especially if he's a valuable piece for the club. And the club has just lost the greatest player of all time. Like, that's put you in a really tough spot to be in. So the Dembélé situation, but for that not to be resolved now here in the wintertime, potentially, but you still able to register Ferran Torres, who was the cheapest big option on the market, who was who agreed to reduce his salary to come to the club and who will actually be a help to the attack, and to also find a way to have Coutinho's wages largely figured out for the next 6 months so you can register Ferran Torres and potentially even some kind of, you know, break the class in case of emergency center back, which we'll talk about in a second with Garcia. But for him to do all of that in a matter of 6 months, it's great business. It's to bring in Ferran Torres, to get Coutinho off the books for 6 months, and to restructure this Umtiti deal, to restructure the, I mean, the PK deal was a thank you to the club. And listen, I usually would be frustrated by all of his tweeting, but, you know, Gerard Piqué, go in your victory lap. Basically, yeah, that's what they're saying. Like, yeah, just, no, do you it. Know, do you do, speak your piece.
Yeah. I mean, the Piqué thing was, and I don't say this in any way to speak against Alemani, but I think the Piqué salary reduction was very much, you know, that was something that Gerard Piqué was kind of always going to do, irrespective of who was at the helm.
Same thing with the Dani Alves deal, by the way. Like, it was like needed, and Dani Alves has taken less money.
Dani Alves is like, I'll play for 130 grand.
You know? Exactly. Thank you for that.
Yeah, exactly. So, but I agree with you. As far as being able to shift the overwhelming majority of the Philippe Coutinho obligation, at least for 6 months, because this is what it is right now. You know, whether it was the loan to Bayern or this move, I mean, he's just on such a massive salary and his stock has fallen so dramatically that you just kind of have to piecemeal solutions. Like, there isn't try as they might, there's not a clean way out of the whole thing. So this is very much just kind of chipping away at the iceberg of the obligation that is, you know, Coutinho's contract. And yeah, and I mean, similarly, it's the Umtiti thing was similar. But yeah, I mean, at this point, it brings the annual number down to a palatable number. And yeah, and I mean, they were able to get Ferran Torres. And I mean, obviously, he made a decision that he would take a reduced salary, you know, just coming back to Spain and coming to FC Barcelona and playing for Barca meant enough to him that he didn't need to wring, you know, every last euro out of his contract that he could. He made his deal. I mean, I'm sure he'll in better financial times, I'm sure he'll, you know, he'll get a contract renewal that maybe compensates him a little bit and makes him a little bit more whole, you know, for the sacrifices he made. Yeah, but I mean, everything that Alemani's done in a span of 6 months is spectacular. I mean, it's, you know, we were speaking every week, you know, particularly right around the start of the season and even, you know, for the first month or two at least, everything just, it had this like almost like this funereal vibe to it, because it was, you know, they can't afford to do anything. Like, they don't have, you know, they can't pay someone $100 to play for them, let alone, you know, millions. And yeah, I mean, they've done more than simply just shuffling deck chairs around. I mean, he's made real meaningful changes, and he's allowed the club to actually have some flexibility and add bona fide talent.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Right, and for Laporta, too, to give him a bit of a compliment on this, too. Like, I mean, I was fearful and critical at the time. I had said that it sounded like Victor Font had a bigger... Well, at least Victor Font had a better laid out plan that he was willing to be public. And I mean, clearly Laporta, his plan was the same one he had back in 2003. And it's that take smart football people, put them in charge of things and let them do their thing. And then I'll just smile and shake hands. And, you know, I've got friends with Mino Raiola and Goldman Sachs and I've got my connections and I'm just going to be the smiley businessman that I am and be this magnanimous figure. Right. And Laporta that, I mean, at the time, of course, I mean, if Barca were a private enterprise, they would have had to go bankrupt just as Laporta was coming in charge. So the compliment to Laporta is that he has let his people do their jobs and he picked the right people. So he does deserve compliments on his leadership that he, you know, because it was worrying. I mean, a shuffling of the deck. I mean, we would have thought that Roman Planas leaving would have been, you know, absolute catastrophe. And it might be with losing his scouting mind in the future. Like they could miss out on talent. So it's going to be frustrating. But the simple fact is like, I think people forget how long a process is going to be where we can discuss how hard it is to come back with results where the club. Yeah, it is worrisome if you're dropping out of the Europa League, not making that Champions League money, just, you know, having your bottom line be lessened and not getting results, not competing for La Liga. Those are all really worrying things where a club can stay in that state of stasis and you get stuck, you know, you're kind of spinning your tires without getting back to the elite. And that can happen. However, for this club financially, we had spoken that it was going to take 2 to 3 years. And if in a matter of less than a year, remember, it was March of 2021 when Laporta stepped into that job. And if the club was able in 1 year's time to go from being able to say, because that's the whole thing. It doesn't matter, I think, not to say anything. It's not a victory if the club says, oh, well, you know, great. It'll be a great success if Erling Haaland comes. But to me, I think Kule's, as again, it's not fun because you're not celebrating really anything, but the fact that the club was in the state that it was in, and now you can say that, I mean, Erling Haaland might be possible. So it actually, like whether or not he happens, isn't actually the point here financially. The point is, it's a huge victory for the club that he is possible. And that means that it doesn't matter if you get Haaland or not. If you can purchase great players for the cost of Erling Haaland, that in itself completely revitalizes the squad.
If you're back playing in the big leagues as far as transfers are concerned.
In 1 year's time?
Yeah, I was going to say inside of 2 years even. That's brilliant. That's phenomenal. And I think like so much of the work that's been done, to your point, is, you know, like there's nothing sexy about kind of reinforcing the, you know, the roof on the house. You know what I mean? Or like, or fixing your, you know, I don't know, like, insulation and things like that. These aren't spectacular things that make people ooh and ah.
Well, my example right now, Emil, where you're listening to this podcast and I'm on my old mic right now because I have to get a new part. I wanted to get a new actual microphone, but now I actually wind up having to fix an old problem so I don't have to go on a lesser microphone. And that's, I mean, I feel you, FC Barcelona.
Yeah, exactly. And like Erling Haaland's like getting the hot tub for the backyard, but
exactly.
But you need to reinforce the roof and make sure the insulation works and your floors are okay and all that stuff. And you don't give it much thought unless like there's something wrong with it. Like you don't think about the roof on your house unless it's leaking, but they've done a great job of plugging the leaks. I mean, the roof was leaking, you know, I mean, it was bad. And at least now we're able to have conversations. Yeah. Like you said, the fact that we can even invoke Erling Haaland's name with, you know, like more than a shred of sanity, you know, like without just being completely unhinged is fantastic.
Yep. I mean, there's still work to be done. I mean, but other than
maybe like, it doesn't happen, but yeah.
Right. I mean, a lot could happen where Atletico Madrid cannot want to, if Atletico Madrid doesn't purchase Antoine Griezmann for 40 million euro, which is still possible. I think there might be, there's something in it where if he plays too much and they have to purchase him, but if they choose not to at some point, and obviously Coutinho might be right back over the summertime with his wages for another year. So, you know, they kick the can down the road for 6 months for that. So this problem isn't completely over, but this Umtiti deal does put the Umtiti salary issue to bed. You still have Dembele to worry about. You still have Roberto. So it's not, you know, we're not on the yellow brick road just yet, but actually we are. But to that point, I feel like they've met the scarecrow at this point, right? I feel like we've met the scarecrow. We're heading to the Tin Man, which I'm all out of whack because that means that the forest when the monkeys attack is still coming. But that, I feel like that's actually, this is a good tangent because that's actually feel like that's happening on the field. And for as good as things have been this week on the financial side in the back office to register Torres, the 1-1 result against Granada is a bad result. And I feel like in these kind of situations with Granada, because of those late equalizers, and this has happened now for Barcelona, they're the only team aside from Cadiz who have lost more points after conceding goals after the 85th minute of games. Cadiz had done seven times.
It feels right, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Cadiz had done it 7 times and Barcelona have done it 6 times. And that has forced them to deal with draws. That would have been wins against Atletico Madrid, Getafe, Mallorca, and Granada. So not great on late game execution this season for FC Barcelona.
Yeah, so basically they've lost, what is it? So that works out to what? They've lost 10 points as a result of?
12 points, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, minimum.
Looking at the table right now, you know, I mean, that's just
would be helpful. Yeah,
yes, you know, like you get half of those points and you're comfortably in third place. You know, I mean, it's Yeah, I mean, that's the difference between not really having any concerns about top four and this kind of the having to figure out how you're going to scrape your way in.
I think from Granada now 2 days later, I think there's 3 points to kind of discuss here after all that. We could, instead of breaking down individual player performance or whatever, I think a lot of people had a lot of mixed reviews on how this game, on who played well, if the team played well. I saw that the match was boring, which I didn't feel like that was the case at all. And then I also saw some people say that, you know, that Barca had played terribly or that I think the only thing everyone agrees on is that they did lose control in the match, and that's why there was an equalizer. But all right, first thing to talk about, though, and I think the longest standing effect of this Granada match, obviously, is that the injury bug will not go away. Eric Garcia now, a hamstring injury for 5 weeks. I was trying to figure out, as I continue to rub in people's faces, that he has been better than I think, you know, when everyone wanted him to be.
Yeah, he's good now.
Yeah. Okay, guys. So, all right. He's good. All right. So stop with that. I got a lot of comments. I could send people a lot of messages privately that if people let me know that Eric Garcia was trash. But my only question for Garcia is, do you think that it's Garcia's doing, or as I've been thinking about Xavi, I mean, Garcia, he's adapted, but he's also been much, much better under Xavi. So, I mean, I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg thing, right? Is it that he finally got comfortable, or is it that Xavi and the fact that Busquets and Piqué have also been really good under Xavi, meaning, as kind of what we've been saying, that Xavi's system allows them to, it just has a higher line of confrontation, and they're smart players, and smart players are able to play in that system positionally and be in the right spots. And it's relying less on Garcia having to do what he doesn't do well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's, you know, a bit of column A, a bit of column B, but so I think he is acclimating and just getting more comfortable. And just as far as, you know, being here and, you know, learning his teammates and everything else. So I think there has just been a natural period of acclimatization for him. And he looks more comfortable just in his surroundings. And yeah, I think the Piqué and Busquets playing better around him, like you said, I mean, these are as experienced and as intelligent a duo as you can have around him. And so that's obviously benefiting him. You know, I mean, he's obviously spoken to those guys and they found a rhythm, you know, something resembling a rhythm together. You know, I mean, there's still work to be done, but they look very good. They look really comfortable, you know, now. And just Eric Garcia himself in a vacuum looks more comfortable and more confident, you know, on the ball and everything. And, you know, and it's probably a bit of both, but I mean, it's probably not coincidental that he's playing better since Xavi arrived, because we have seen, like you said, Piqué and Busquets have seen their form, you know, elevate since Xavi's arrival. I mean, shoot, Luke de Jong is, you know, playing, you know, so I think.
And Nico too. And Nico's been great too. Yeah. Like, so there is a direct correlation. It feels like it's not just,
there's,
you know,
like there's certain being players.
La Masia based players. Like and I'm going to take it to that level where, you know, it's not just this La Masia bias, like, oh, Xavi's brought back the golden age of the academy and all players who know the Barca way are playing better. But right now there is a little bit of correlation where players who seem to have come from the academy at any point are playing better under Xavi. I think actually with the exception, oddly enough, of Jordi Alba, who I think has kind of been hot or cold since Xavi.
Yeah, like he's
But yeah, he also doesn't look fully healthy because, and that's the other thing too, no one is fully healthy. That's actually why I bring up the Garcia injury, that it's another unfortunate case where this guy was in form and even Eric Garcia found his form, something that nobody thought he could find. He found it and now he's hurt. So I guess that's a lesson for Barcelona players. Do not find your form. Don't play well. I mean, for Nico, he's put together, I think, 4 or 5 straight good matches. So Nico, for goodness sake, like don't walk down your steps without a help.
Everyone just try to be quietly competent, but don't draw any attention to yourself. Right. Try not to be exceptional. Just everyone do a workmanlike job.
Well, the other thing with Garcia too, is I feel like in the match, and I think the big question here, again, the other two talking boards are tied into this. Mm-hmm. Why did Barcelona lose the match? I think lose control of that match is what we're trying to answer. Busquets said right after the match that, hey, 17-year-old Gabi, that's why we're talking about this, because Gabi got the red. One less player means you have a lot less control. And then to me, actually, the Eric Garcia injury had a huge effect on it because, I mean, he just does settle everything down when Barca have the ball. And Granada might have still continued to push harder, bring up the pressure as they did from the 20 to the 25th minute. Mm-hmm. But a lot of Granada's pressure was coming down the flanks. When they were having good success up in Granada, it was by going 1v1 at Dani Alves and taking advantage of the fact that Dembele did not show up for that match offensively or defensively. He just had to switch off. I said it on the match review. Sometimes he has to switch on. Sometimes he has to switch off. Today, I mean, that day, that was completely off. So for Dembele, it wasn't great. He wasn't helping Alves. And Alves was trying to invert and come in the middle and help with control in the middle. But Granada were completely pinning him to the wing, which was when Barca would lose control of that match. And then for Gabi, it could have been the red. And then the other one people are saying is that Xavi's decision to put in Memphis for Luke de Jong was also the other major reason why Barca lost control of this match. But certainly the issue was control. And first, before we go there, let's do the Gabi thing now. I mean, is there anything new that you have to say about Gabi getting this red?
Not really. I don't know. I mean, I think it was a rash kind of out of control moment by a 17-year-old. I mean, he was trying to play aggressively. And, when stuff like that works, it gets praised and it's what you want out of your young players to play with, assertiveness and aggression. When it goes wrong, it can be, ugly and crippling in the latter stages of a game. No, I mean, I think it was rash. It was, not brilliant. And it went just wrong enough where he couldn't even skate with a yellow. He had to walk. And
it was a second yellow. I mean, it was even a red, actually. It was a second yellow. And it happened on Callado, which is fresh. I mean, it was cool to see Callado get on the pitch, but for Callado, it was nothing that Callado did wrong. He didn't sell that at all. He got taken out from behind.
No, he got taken out. I don't think it's indicative of, any kind of larger issue or anything like that. I mean, just young player tried to make a play, went in hard, and it didn't work.
I think makes that even more frustrating. Actually, again, I talk a lot about FC Barcelona in a week and make a lot of content. So it is frustrating me that I have nothing new or novel to say about Gabi getting a red because, for those who are saying that, I went in hard on Puig after Linares and I didn't go hard in on Gabi, but Gabi actually had a fine performance other than the 2 yellow cards, which were both bad cards. So he has this one thing, it's crazy because Gabi is so good that the one thing you can say is that his pro is that he's always fighting. He fights harder than anyone on the team. He's very aggressive, especially for his size and his age. And then the con with that is that he gets too aggressive at times. And it seemed like he had a few good weeks where he wasn't picking up rash cards. And now it seems like, he got a red. He's right back to it. And it's that's like one of those weird ones where other than for me, I think it's positional where he really does have to learn his body. And I think people are saying it's emotion. It's a shot of blood to the head. So sometimes that can come with experience where you have to be experienced stuff but I don't think people think, some guys play angry. Professional footballers, generally, to understanding their psychology, they don't play completely unhinged like Sunday football.
Not furious in most cases.
And there's aggression that is necessary to play. I mean, it's like here in the NFL, there are guys NFL, it's called personality disassociating. there's a ton of NFL players that are just like the nicest guys and then completely disassociate to basically kill a man or try their best to like
psychopaths for 3-4 hours on a Sunday
in between these lines. And like if Gabby, if he's emotionally disassociating so to become as aggressive as he needs to be, because he is all indications are he's just a nice kid. He's a nice 17-year-old regular kid. But that said, like, how do you fix that? How do you take away the red card without taking away his aggression and desire and fight? And I think the answer to that is that he will get more comfortable with experience to understand positionally and with his own body. I can, you know, in the way that Busquets is perfect at saying, I have a reach of whatever it is, and I can get to that guy because I have, you know what I mean? Like, and for Gabby, he'll learn, I can't get there with this tackle, or I can, and he'll make those decisions accordingly. And that comes with experience.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, I think there's a certain situational awareness that comes with experience, and there's no reason to believe that he won't, you know, he won't gain that. He won't accumulate that, you know, build up that situational awareness. He's very young and he plays aggressively, which, I mean, like I said, it's the kind of thing that you want. On the spectrum of issues that you can have with a young player in this situation, I would rather have to figure out how to sort of dial him back a little bit and hope that, you know, the experience and just greater knowledge just kind of tempers this a little bit than if he were excessively, you know, overly passive and you had to constantly try to light a fire under the guy. So, because I think this one is more doable than, because if someone just simply doesn't have the intensity and the aggression, it's hard to instill that in someone where you can kind of teach someone how to channel it more effectively.
Right.
As they grow up.
Well, I mean, let me do the opposite of that. I think the opposite is a worrying this game that the likes of Alba and Pique and Busquets that people continue to talk about, that leadership group, their inability to lead through adversity is continuing to be a worrying thing. And unlike Gabby, that I think through experience will get better. Pique has been great as a leader, as just as a stalwart at the back, and Busquets, of course, I think has been fine as a captain. But there is this thing that this unit, this group of leadership, it's not just even one individual, this leadership group, Ter Stegen as well in net, there's something that happens in the late parts of games. And again, that number that I told you 6 times, this team has lost points after conceding goals and the 85th minute or later. So that is indicative of a pattern. And that pattern, I mean, does go on your leadership. You do go, it goes on the players who are expected to guide you through those difficult moments. And they haven't been able to do that. And they deserve criticism for that. And Busquets and Pique also say in their comments too, that they're accepting of that criticism because it is on their, and their leadership. Yeah. And we're fair to say that. And then the other person that falls on, of course, is Xavi. And I think that's why, I think there's a huge difference between his late game decision-making and his tactics as a whole, where it's, and I think this Luke de Jong Memphis one was, I think we went too far with it in that I think so many people who are saying, oh, I would have kept Luke de Jong because there's this idea that if a striker is in form and banging in goals, then you keep him on. But I go, hey, 90 minutes ago, even though he was the player of the game or match of the man of the match against Mallorca, you still said, why is he playing at all? And most of us still had Jukla back in the middle in our starting lineups and Luke de Jong on the bench, even after what he did against Mallorca. So then you are going to, you know, revise history and say, because things didn't work out, then therefore the Xavi made the wrong decision to take off Luke de Jong, who has only played 90 minutes twice this year against Osasuna and Mallorca, and Memphis Depay is coming back in. And you'd expect, the expectation is that Memphis should being, I think, better holding the ball up, you'd expect that he was actually going to aid with control. And the fact that Granada pushing were leaving more space in behind. So you would think on, in theory, that Eze Abde and Memphis would be better at exploiting that space in behind. So, I mean,
I thought those things.
Exactly. Doesn't it make sense why Xavi made the decision he is? And because it didn't work out, now we're saying that it was the wrong choice to put Memphis in for Luke de Jong. The only thing that we had that Xavi had was that if Memphis wasn't physically prepared to be in that match, then he should not have entered that match.
Yeah.
No matter what. And that's the only information we don't have.
No, exactly. I mean, it's kind of the, you know, the phrase that I threw out earlier when we were talking about the Umtiti thing was like, it was good process, bad result, because the whole thing makes sense to swap out de Jong for, or, you know, swap in Memphis for de Jong at that point. And like you said, the relative strengths and Memphis's ability to hold up the ball, that's what you would want. He's a good player, and he's also, what he's good at is well suited to what Barca needed at that moment. And, you know, just with that amount of time left, it simply didn't work out. And yeah, I mean, maybe there is something going on. Maybe he's not 100% or, you know, whatever. He wasn't mentally dialed in, you know, wasn't ready to play, you know, whatever it is. We can speculate, but obviously he wasn't at peak effectiveness. And, but I think an otherwise sensical decision ends up looking bad because, but it made sense. I mean, the thought process and the decision were sound from where I sit.
Yeah. I mean, I continue to say that Xavi's tactics, I mean, are just, again, he's smarter than all of us. Like, as much as you think, you know, I mean, Xavi knows his tactics better than we do. And I think he very rarely has he done the thing. I don't know. Like, it's been so gratifying to me to go like, oh, if I was a manager, I feel like that's what I would have done. And it seems like almost every starting lineup, every decision that he's made, it's like, to me, always like, not to say that I like blindly am following Xavi, but I think there are times where he's made some late game decisions where you did. And I think he should have questioned it. But then for Xavi, I think he is making so many times like the decision that you would make, but then he's not getting the thing he needed out of the player that he asked to do the job. And I think that will come with time as well too, potentially, or you just need to enhance the quality of the player, because even a Luke de Jong, Xavi has gotten so much. Can you believe that they got, I mean, a win against Linares midweek. And I mean, that's without Luke de Jong. And then the win against Mallorca last weekend. And then even today, yesterday, a draw against Granada is huge as well. And you think about Luke de Jong, right? The offside goal yesterday and then the back heel.
Yeah, that one was so harsh.
being appetizers for the goal. And that's his second in two Liga games. So for Luke de Jong to go from coming under Koeman, because Koeman wanted him, to...
Yeah.
I mean, basically helping you win 4 points in the Liga.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I'm trying to see this with a glass half full. I know people are negative, but like to get that out of Luke de Jong, to be able to squeeze that much out of a player that was definitely going to have his contract terminated this week. And now I have to ask you, Emil, does that mean that with Luke's performance of the last week, now we have to question a week later, because Ferran Torres can be registered, does either Luke or Brathwaite get sent out? Like, you obviously can't sell Brathwaite without him being able to play, and he has no market at the moment, like, because he's out and injured. And canceling Luke's loan just gets his wages off the books since he's on loan. But with Umtiti's contract, and if there are no other signings, then why not just keep him if he is proving to be a little bit useful right now? So now you're stuck with Luke, not stuck with, but now instead of being stuck with Luke de Jong or Brathwaite, now you have other just options that exist. If he gets something out of Luke de Jong.
Look, I mean, Luke de Jong is giving the team, like, Luke de Jong is providing what you would look to Luke de Jong to provide.
Right.
You know, he's like a big dude in the middle. He's in the box and he gets his head on the ball. And there's value to that. And particularly for a team that's so, you know, both racked with injuries and, you know, they've been, you know, personnel-wise, they've been hamstrung financially and all of that. I mean, this is... Right now, these are kind of scraping you're scraping results, and it's not aesthetically pleasing the way, you know, the Luke de Jong way isn't always the aesthetically pleasing way that we all might want, but
commit to it. I mean, it's not what we want to see from FC Barcelona.
No, but it's results. I mean, right now it's, you know, we can pretty it all up later, but, you know, we need Champions League places next year. And, you know, it's just, you know, all of these other things are secondary, but no, I mean, the guy's playing sort of as the best version of himself. And, you know, I do think that there's probably value in keeping him around because, you know, there are injuries and, you know, right now he's playing well, he's showing up to play and he's doing the thing that's asked of him. And I mean, he's arguably doing that as well as any attacker on the team. And so to sort of jettison him out of the team at this moment in time just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Right. Cause you don't know how well Ansu's going to come back. And I mean, Dembele will continue to play regardless of his contract situation. But I mean, aesthetically, is it a worry that FC Barcelona scored the most headed goals of any team in the Liga this season with 8 more than the whole of last season? They had 7 all of last year. So the fact that they're just this towering head the ball in the back net, that's how we get goals. We don't get goals really from, you know, complete open play. Pretty goals don't happen at FC Barcelona anymore. Yeah. So aesthetically, it's worrisome. And that's, I think, why people call the a Barcelona match is, you know, some will say it's boring or some will say it's not enjoyable to watch. But again, players are still getting healthy, hopefully. And we'll see as we pivot to Barca versus Real Madrid and Spanish Super Cup in Saudi Arabia. Ansu Fati, Frankie de Jong, and Ronald Araujo have all been put as, you know, in the squad to travel, where likely they might get a green light or they might not. On, you know, it's a bit of gamemanship there. I don't think we're going to, I mean, if we see any of them, I mean, even Araujo having had a hand surgery like 2 days ago and being back in the, back in the squad is incredible. Yeah. My hands are thinking about it, but against Real Madrid with this El Clasico, I mean, I think it's no secret that this is Spanish Super Cup in Saudi Arabia. This is the lowest common denominator of an El Clasico. It's, you know, it's happening, and that's basically all I'm saying, but because it's Madrid and because it's in a season that Barcelona need to hold on to every bit of optimism they have. I don't know. Like, am I supposed to view this as, again, glass half full? Am I supposed to view this as a good test for the team and to say, hey, last time these two teams met, Barca lost to Real Madrid because they were not in the same stratosphere. They lost to Bayern Munich because they were a far inferior team. Now, a few weeks on, a few months later of the Xavi project, Xavi, again, the third most all-time Clásico appearances behind just Messi and Sergio Ramos. Like, this is his first El Clasico. So, like, as much as I want to say that Spanish Super Cup, Saudi Arabia, a year where not everybody's healthy, you know, a year where La Liga matters, a year when you're in Europa League, that this game, you know, on an island doesn't matter, but also El Clasico always matters. And so, like, you know what I mean? I'm caught between two minds here.
So I think, on the one hand, I do think just for Xavi himself, because, I mean, you always go back to those, you know, that those glory days of the, when there was like a Clásico every 4 or 5 weeks, it felt like, and just
2011.
But even just that whole, and you know, and then there was the other years where there weren't, but that entire era of sort of the early Cristiano Ronaldo and, you know, the Xavi, Iniesta, Messi, like those games were all sort of, those were all powder kegs, and these guys were all on the front lines for some absolutely, you know, they were in some cauldron environments at the Bernabeu, and, you know, and conversely, you know, just with some, so, I mean, I feel like that's going to matter to Xavi. I mean, just simply seeing the badge on the Real Madrid shirt to a certain extent, you know, I think just given his experience and his lifelong indoctrination with the club, I think it's a simple case of we must beat Real Madrid. Like, it doesn't matter who, like, we're playing their youth team. We need to hammer these guys. So I think there's a little bit of that.
Well, the greatest achievement of Elas Moriba's career is scoring the hat trick against the Real Madrid U19s. And that was like, when he came up to the first team, the first thing everyone was always kept saying was that, hey, this is the key to the hat trick against Real Madrid. Like, but that wasn't like Casemiro he scored against. That was a 17-year-old Real Madrid player.
I know, it's just like some other, it's another teenage kid. Yeah. But so I think there's that. I'm interested to see what kind of a lineup Madrid puts out. But I mean, given the gulf in quality that there was in, you know, when the two sides met earlier in the year, and like you said, in the Bayern games as well, just Barca looked nowhere. Yeah, I mean, I think you said just not even in the same stratosphere. I mean, they were playing different sports almost. And so I do think there's a certain element, because I don't think Madrid's just gonna mail in this game. Like, I don't think they're gonna punt it and just accept the loss. So I mean, I think it's a measuring stick to a certain extent.
I think it's also a win-win result, I think, because, again, no offense to the Spanish Super Cup. I mean, I think people know how much I defend the Copa del Rey, but the Spanish Super Cup in particular in Saudi Arabia, this is a paycheck for Barcelona. This is why they're going. They're just trying to cash this check. And listen, having the weekend off with this injured squad, like, isn't the baddest thing. Like, the worst part of this is potentially losing to Real Madrid, honestly. Like, and I know that you want any trophy this year, and Xavi might go trophy-less, but I want to remind people that, like, as far as optics go, and this is the same thing in Catalonia. Yeah. If Xavi says, hey, I won the Spanish Super Cup in my first year, everybody is going to go, who cares? Who cares if you won the Spanish Super Cup? Like, you know, that's not going to count as a real trophy.
Oh, I don't even think it would be worse than that. I mean, I think he would be openly derided. Like, because that's Jose Mourinho stuff, where it was like, you know, like,
I don't think Xavi would do that.
Yeah. Like, no, I mean, he'd win like a prize at an arcade and just be like, hey, like, this is part of a treble. No. I don't think you do that. And I think Xavi knows better than to do that.
Yeah, he would do that.
Because I think it'd be, but I think it's just the simple fact of we're back at the races with Madrid. We are capable of beating Real Madrid more than anything, whether there's a trophy on the line or not. Like, you don't want to be plainly inferior to your, you know, sworn rival.
Well, and even so, like,
I think it's that.
Yeah, it's even me. Like, you know me with the history. Like, you know, I know for the first Spanish Super Cup that they did win was in 1983, I think it was. And that was like the days of Alex Anko, who's now back with the club, and Francisco Lobo Carrasco. And I think Keeney also came in to be in the final or whatever in that match.
Yeah, I think it was right around that time. Yeah.
Yeah. So like 1983. So like this is, again, a Spanish Super Cup only goes back to 1982. Like, you're talking about then other cups that nobody's heard of, like the Copa Eva Duarte, which was back in the 40s and 50s. Those are like the predecessors. Like
the Martini Rossi Cup. And
There was one. Well, that was like way. There was called the Copa de Campeones, which was like, again, back in the teams of the era of the five cups back in the early 50s.
That was the Kubala time.
So like, again, this Spanish Super Cup, even its modern iteration, only goes back to like 83. So for me, like, the Juan Gamper trophy actually matters almost as much as this one. And that's the one that Barca created basically to give themselves for the re-intro of a season. So yeah, I mean, like, again, you know me, like, I care about all trophies. I care about Copa del Rey. I care about the history. I care about, like, you know, it's always paying respect to those who come before you, and, you know, the likes of Amor and Vaquero and Salinas and Bajirstein and Stoichkov, those who fought for this title before, you know, because again, this is a cup that Barcelona have won a ton of times. You know, that said, again, coming back to that 2011 edition that you're talking about being the most infamous, they won in 2009, 10, and 11, did Barcelona. And it came against Real Madrid in what happened to be a 5-4 aggregate, because it used to be two legs. So it was 5-4 on aggregate, and it mattered, right? Like, it mattered that year. But this year, we can confidently say that this does not matter. But yes, I'm still going to do the same thing. It's a match that I'm going to watch the match. I'm going to watch the 90 minutes. If they lose to Real Madrid when they could have beat Real Madrid, I'm going to be frustrated like everybody else. I'm not saying it's not like that I'm going to throw it away no matter the result, but I am saying that, like, it's a lot easier of a pill to swallow in an El Clasico loss due to the nature of everything else surrounding this match, where it doesn't really matter on an island. It just matters because you lost to Real Madrid. That's the only
thing. I agree. And I mean, I think similarly to how you're looking at it, you know, I'm going to watch the game, and the biggest thing is, If Barca win, you know, kind of counterintuitively, I don't care about the Spanish Super Cup. I will be delighted that they beat Real Madrid. The one thing that's kind of unfortunate is that Xavi's first Clásico isn't at Camp Nou or the Bernabeu, but it's in
Saudi Arabia. You know,
Saudi Arabia.
Yep.
So that, I mean, there's that element of it that I wish there was, you know, a little bit more of kind of local passion and just, you know, angry fans and, you know, like, some of that. But all the same, I mean, it's Barca and Madrid, and, you know, it's Xavi's first Clásico. It's, you know, it's kind of fittingly, it's, you know, given the strange times we're in, it's fitting that Xavi's first Clásico is sort of a bit of an odd one. And I'm optimistic, and I do sincerely feel like, you know, trying as best I can to get in Xavi's head, I feel like he wants to beat Madrid, and and, you know, he needs the good vibes around the club.
Yeah, it's a huge bump. Hey,
we took down Madrid. I think would go a very long way right now too.
I think you're right. I think this team, I you know, I'm pretty unemotional guy. I mean, when I play, I'm actually criticized by teammates and stuff in the sports that I play for not, like, for always being, you know, the Iceman, like, always, like, there's no moment is a moment. Like, it's all calm. Like, every moment is a moment. But I think I almost take for granted that, you know, especially these professionals, that momentum matters, and that winning against Real Madrid, even if you lose the final, beating Real Madrid and be able to say, hey, we're the team that lost to Bayern Munich, but now look at where we are now. Look at the progress we've made on the Xavi, and we have everybody getting healthy, and everything is coming up Barcelona in the same way that you're right. You look at the standings and you go, hey, Barcelona are 2 points away from third place. Like, Barcelona and are now potentially getting as healthy as they are. Their tactics are as put together as they've been in. Fucking, again, I don't want to overstate, but I do trust Xavi. So, I mean, if their tactics are the most put together they've been in 4 or 5 years, and they have a team that's getting healthier at all at the right time. And now they're potentially able to spend over the summer. They have Ferran Torres coming in a few weeks when he comes back from COVID. So, and the foot injury. So they're in a good spot, and it's all positive. And like, if you can take that positivity against Real Madrid, put them to the sword, you're in a great spot. So I do end the show with, I got bad news and good news for you to end the show, Emil. Barca B lost the bottom of the table in the third division, the Primera division, to Real Betis B, who are bottom of the table. So Barca B is not in a good moment at the moment. That said, most of their team is with the first team at the moment. Right. So yeah. I want to throw that out there. However, like, Idas Comas did play, and he wasn't great against Barca B. He actually played better, to my money, against Mallorca than he did against Real Betis B. And even Alfaro Sanz, right? Alfaro Sanz comes off the bench against Granada because he's a defensive midfielder. So he comes off the bench instead of Puig because Xavi wanted that profile. He wanted to close out a game. So he went with the defensive midfielder, even though he's a Barca B player. He is still 20 years old, so he's been around a little bit. So he goes to Sanz in that one. And so, you know, you have players playing twice in a weekend. You have, again, some, you know, continuity errors with training. And I'm not going to make excuses for Sergi Barjuan. I think there were questions about his managing and his ability to manage a team prior to, in comparison to Garcia Pimienta, which I think tactically were huge shoes to try to fill. So I think Barjuan is kind of, Sergi is getting, you know, a little bit of rightful criticism in that way. That said, again, for Barca B, it's a long-term thing. They're still in striking distance of potentially getting the promotion playoffs. And another reminder too, that with all these Barca players, B players getting the jump to the first team, if Barca B is able to tread water, like, you know what I mean? Like, how do I measure their success at this point in the year? It's that if they tread water in that enhanced new third division, I think that's a net positive. If they're promoted to the second division, awesome. But they just don't want to get relegated back down to the fourth division because that isn't really a good level.
No, exactly. I mean, that would be a particularly bad look. But I do think, and interestingly, the non-football sport that I'm going to bring in is not NBA basketball this year, but it's kind of like I'm not like a huge scholar of baseball or, you know, baseball prospecting and stuff like that. But it's, you know, when some team has a great farm system and they have a whole ton of prospects, all of a sudden they'll go from number one or number two to like number 25 in the rankings because they graduated all of their good guys. And like all of the, you know, sort of the future assets are now on your team. And it's hard to have a sort of a perpetual conveyor belt of, you know, we graduate one good prospect and like, lo and behold, there's instantly another great one to just slide in. Like, it takes a minute. So Barca B is, done a pretty good job of stocking the first team with talent. Yes, I mean, it does stand to reason that sort of there needs to be a moment of kind of replenishing. And if they're able to just simply tread water, you know, I mean, it'd be great if they got to the second tier. But I mean, if they're able to just, like you said, just tread water and play well. Don't lose to bottom of the table teams, you know, stuff like that.
Right, exactly.
I think that would be totally fine.
Yeah, the excuse I continue to make for them is that the third division is a lot better. Like, Atletico Baleares has now moved on to the next round of the Copa del Rey. And they're a team that Barca played. I think they beat Baleares earlier this year. They're the rival, if you will, of Mallorca on the island, even though they're never in the same division, by the way. They actually swapped places at one time when Mallorca dropped down to the third. So, yes, but Atletico Baleares has been good. I mean, Linares was a team that Barca B got a result against. You know, they basically played the exact same match that the first team did against Linares, and they did it early in the season. So the level in the third division is a little bit, it's good enough that these kids are getting the training and work they need in matches to make the step to the first team, where it's a jump, but it's not an uncomfortable jump. It's not like you're going from the fourth division to the top. So Barca B, the goal is to not get relegated back to the fourth division. That's the goal, and to stay in the third division. And then the other good news I have for you, I guess, that one was a good news, but the good news I have for you is that the Femini will be playing their Women's Champions League Cup at tie against Real Madrid at the Camp Nou, which is awesome news. I hope even if they only have I think that they're expecting 6,000 to 8,000 spectators. So I'm hoping that they do get that number. I'm hoping people show up. You get 6,000 to 8,000.
I mean, I want to go. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, so wait,
I'm going to make a legitimate effort to actually be there. I can hopefully kind of report back with some,
how the atmosphere and all that.
First-hand observations.
Yeah, because unfortunately they have almost everything to lose here, where if people don't show up and Real Madrid somehow, through an act of God, really, get a result over the Femenil at home, then they have all to lose. And it's frustrating because the Femenil standard is just win everything and have and hope that more and more people get on this bandwagon and you can peel more Barca fans off from the first team. And yeah, I mean, there are those Barca, I only watch the first team. I don't care about the other teams. And, you know, they exist and fine. You know, that's their opinion. It's fair for them to exist in this world. But yeah, I mean, I was excited to watch the Femini and I'm glad they're at the Camp Nou. So that's not a good news. I have no other, nothing.
I'm super excited for that as well.
Yeah. I mean, they deserve it. They've played well enough and let's see how many people show up. So, and then again, by how many goals do they beat Real Madrid is the other question, but that's El Clasico.
My regular running joke is just go ahead and like lay a touchdown with them and just, you know, and they keep doing it. I think their last two, well, I think there was a 5-0 in the middle there, but because I think it's been 7-5 and 7 lately.
I can't believe I'm still doing this, but I think the difference between a win against Real Madrid nowadays, even though Madrid is only in its second year of actually being like financially resourced, they have some good players, and Real Madrid have gone out and bought some quality players, and they've upgraded all of their training and their dressing room, and they actually treat them as an actual respectable team,
like an actual
now.
Part of the club,
right? And that's huge, and that means that when the Femini go out and they destroy a team that are semi-professional, and you question the professionalism of Spanish football, you question, television rights, all that stuff. So it's one thing when they beat somebody 9-1 that just doesn't have, you know, the financial backing of the club, but Real Madrid is an actual team. Same thing like when they go out and they stomp. Hopefully someday they stomp Lyon, or when they go out and they stomp Chelsea in the Champions League final. Mm-hmm. Those are teams that do have the financial backing. So this is really mano a mano. This isn't just the Femini being able to use Barca money to dominate. This is actually mano a mano teams that are. And so Real Madrid, they're trying to put themselves in that pantheon. They did make it to this round of the Champions League for a reason. So going out and destroying them 5-0 is not. I'm not going to roll my eyes at it. I'm going to say, hey, Real Madrid are trying to catch up. So basically, it's the same thing with the first team. If the first team lose to Real Madrid 3-0, Real Madrid goes, hey, we're way farther along in our progress than you are. And the same thing, the Femini, if they beat this Real Madrid Feminino 5-0, then hey, you're way behind us. But you have the ability to catch up to us. But right now,
better,
you're way behind
still
us.
Still not there. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
All right, but I think we have gotten all the way to the end of our show. We've gotten all the way there. It's another edition of the show wrapped up. Follow Emil Evanesian on Twitter, of course. Then we are on Twitter and Instagram at the Barca in the Pod, FMT13 for me. We're on Patreon, as you know. Help us keep making these shows over there, those match reviews. And I do put everything in case you're not on YouTube or podcast, or in case you don't want to go to a million different places. If you sign up, $3 Patreon, you basically get all the content. I think I try to put every bit of content that I make up over there, except for the articles for the website. So we're also on YouTube, as I said, at the Barcelona Podcast. We're on our way to 10,000 subscribers. So I'm supposed to get there at the end of February, but I'd like to beat that. I'd like to give it, I don't think my wife cares if I get her 10,000 subscribers for Valentine's Day, but I don't know. It'd be a nice gift. It'd be a loving gift from you to me if you could subscribe on the YouTube channel. So that'd be great if you're not doing that already. And thanks so much for listening to the Barcelona Podcast. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon. And Forza Barca.
Forza Barca.